Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy Thanksgiving a little early. On today's program, in part one, we're going to be talking with the author of a book called The Gratitude Diaries, talking about some ways in which she tried to fold gratitude into the fabric of her daily life. In part two of our program, we're going to be hearing from somebody from the famous Boyardee family. Yes, Chef Boyardee. Chef Boyardee was a real person. And we're going to be hearing from his granddaughter in part two of today's program. Stay with us. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we are going to be talking about gratitude. Gratitude is one of those words that is much bandied about, and yet in many instances we really don't stop to think about it, about its importance, and we certainly don't always take the time to be concerted about weaving true gratitude into our daily lives. Janice Kaplan embarked on a year-long journey to become more grateful, to weave gratitude into her daily life. At the time that she began this, she was a relatively happy and very successful person, someone who had enjoyed great success as a television producer, writer, best-selling author, and yet somehow she felt that something was missing, which kept her from maybe fully appreciating life and all of its beauty. What was missing was the deepest kind of gratitude. So for a year, she not only looked at her own life and ways in which she could herself become more grateful, but also looked at many of the studies that have been done about gratitude and its tangible effect on people's well-being. And so the book which resulted from all of that, called The Gratitude Diaries, is not only a chronicle of her own personal journey, but also a collection of a lot of collective wisdom on the topic of gratitude, what it is to be grateful, and the difference that gratitude can make in our lives. The full story of the book is The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life, published by Dutton. Janice Kaplan is well-known for a number of different professional accomplishments, including a long tenure as editor-in-chief of Parade magazine, at the time the most widely circulated magazine in the country. She was co-author of a previous bestseller called I'll See You Again. Again, her newest book is called The Gratitude Diaries. Janice Kaplan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I am very, very happy about this opportunity indeed. So explain to our listeners a little bit more about your state of mind at the time when you decided that gratitude needed to be more a part of your life. From what you write about yourself at that point in time, you weren't a particularly negative person, I don't think, and yet somehow you've found that there was, in a sense, something wanting in your life. Describe what your state of being was at the time and in a sense, what you thought was missing.
Well, I think you described it beautifully in the introduction, that all of us need something a little bit deeper in our lives. And we tend to think that it's going to be the events of our lives that will make us happy. And from so much of the research that I had done on for other projects, I knew that that just wasn't true, that once we achieve something, it becomes what we expect. Psychologists refer to it as habituation, that you get something, you want something, and you want it, and then you achieve it, whether it's a great job, whether it's a marriage or a shiny new car. You have it, and then you stop noticing it because it becomes the baseline. And then you start wanting the next thing, and you start wanting something more. And professionally, I had really certainly had achieved a lot. I appreciated that, and my personal life all was fine. But I think some of us just spend a lot of time always wondering what the next step is going to be and what's going to come along that's going to be really more terrific than what we already have. And maybe next year that great thing will strike and I'll be more satisfied. And I realized that what I needed to do was to change my attitude, not wait for something to happen. And so I challenged myself to spend that year living gratefully, and that's what led to the Gratitude Diaries.
One thing that you just described reminds me of a very important point, which I think you made, that a lot of people who read this book and or hear this interview have busy lives in the professional world, and if they are successful, they have achieved that success, at least in part, because of their own sense of ambition. And more than once in the book, you sort of point out something I'd never really stopped to think about before, namely that sense of ambition can be one of the trickiest complications when it comes to being grateful, to being satisfied. How does one reconcile being satisfied with what you have, feeling like what you have or what you've accomplished is enough, versus being ambitious to achieve still more?
Well, it's a great question, and it's exactly what I worried about as I started the year, because I thought, okay, if I end up the year and gratitude is just something platitudinous that makes you say, oh, everything is fine, all is well, that's not going to be a success because that's not who I am. And so I knew that gratitude had to be something that really worked with the rest of my life and with the fact that I wanted to appreciate what I have, but that didn't mean I wanted to be patted on the back and told, either literally or metaphorically, and told that everything was okay. So I was very happy to start doing some of the research and to find out that in many studies, people who are grateful actually end up being more successful because what gratitude does is it makes you happier about your life. And when you're happier about your life and when you're excited about what you're doing, you get up earlier in the morning and you're looking for other things and you're filled with excitement and energy. And really that's what I found gratitude did for me. And, you know, I live in New York, so I have lots of edgy friends who really worried that I was going to end up being so happy-sappy at the end of this year that they wouldn't be able to talk to me. And instead, I think they were quite taken by discovering how well gratitude does work in even for the most ambitious people and in helping us go on. Another really interesting fact about gratitude at work is that a lot of bosses think that they shouldn't say thanks to the people who work for them. You hear that grumbling, oh, we say thank you with a paycheck. Well, they couldn't be more wrong. People are motivated by being appreciated. We all want to be appreciated. There was one study out of the London School of Economics that looked at research in the field over many years, and they found that the number one motivator on the job was actually being appreciated. And for bosses, in that same survey that I had done, we found that people who are grateful are more likely to be successful because the people they work for will rally around them. And none of us succeed on our own. We actually need the people there who are going to help us.
Hmm. We're speaking with Janice Kaplan about her new book called The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life. So, of course, some people who might come to the same realization that I need to be more grateful, I need to have more gratitude in my life would just sort of start to try to be more grateful in a fairly sort of nebulous, open-ended fashion. You didn't go about it that way at all. You decided instead that this would be a year-long project broken up by a focus on different facets of gratitude, different things to be grateful about month by month by month. Is that just who you are? And did that fit kind of your own personal matrix of your personality and values? Or do you think that is a valuable framework that just about everybody should adopt for themselves in terms of becoming more grateful?
Well, yes and yes. I think, first of all, for me, it worked very well because I'm a journalist, and I need to do things in an orderly way and to have support for what I'm doing. I didn't want it to just be my year. I really wanted this year to be supported by research, by interviews, by explanations for what was happening. So the book is very grounded in information that people can use. But I also think that it's important for us to do things to take particular steps and to know that we're going to do something specific. Somebody said to me that gratitude isn't a feeling, gratitude is an action. And I really love that because we can sit around and sort of think, oh, I'm grateful, but unless we express it to somebody or we write it down or we do something that shows it, we're not going to get the full effects from it. So I think taking it on in a serious way, even by doing something as simple as keeping a gratitude journal, writing down one thing every day that makes you grateful, will help you focus on doing it.
You actually ended up beginning this journey of gratitude very much at home, first with your own husband and then with your two sons, in terms of appreciating them more and I think along the way hoping that they might also become more appreciative and grateful along the way. But as you describe them, it sounds like in many respects both your husband and both of your two sons had a lot going for them already in terms of, generally speaking, being very grateful people. And maybe in some ways you had something to learn from them about what gratitude really was.
Very perceptive, yes. I sometimes think my older son is much more mature than I am. I think as my kids are grown up now, but when they were younger, we used to, once a week, when we tried to have dinner together as often as we could, but at least once a week, we always had a family dinner on a Friday night, and we would start that dinner by the line was something good that happened. And it was just something good that had happened in the course of that week, and everybody would talk about it. And I realized later that was a gratitude lesson. That was a way of instilling in them the sense of, yeah, we can spend a lot of time talking about all the terrible things that happen when you're in fourth grade, but once a week at least we're going to pause and say, let's look at all of the good things that happened. And perhaps that instilled something in them and gave them the ability to reframe situations so that they wanted to, it became natural to them. You know, kids don't know to be grateful unless you help them because they don't have anything to compare it to. They have one life, and probably most of their friends' lives are not too dissimilar from theirs. So reminding kids not to just think about what they don't have, but to think about what they do have can really make a big difference for them. With my husband, I had been married a long time, and I'm married to a really great guy, and I'd stopped noticing that, and I think that a lot of us do that. A lot of us, just the person that we're supposed to love most in the whole world becomes the background to our lives rather than somebody that we pay attention to. And that didn't seem right. So the very first month of my year, I devoted to my husband, and I devoted to trying to say thank you to him every day and trying to appreciate him. And it comes back in spades. He started noticing I didn't make a big deal of it. I didn't even tell him what I was doing because at the beginning I wasn't completely sure what I was doing. But he noticed it. And then he started appreciating me. And then he started thanking me for the things that I normally do. And the whole vibe between us started to change. And I think we started to trust each other more. We got much closer. And at the end of that year, we both said that for no particular reason, nothing dramatic had happened that year. We'd not had any big life event, but somehow it had been the best year together that we'd ever had. And we certainly wanted to see if we can keep that going.
Hmm. As you enlarge the circle of this journey to involve other people in your life and then your sphere of work and matters like health and so on, at one point you realize that, in your words, the one downside to the positivity that I suddenly was that you suddenly found yourself excessively sensitive to people who weren't grateful. That is something which probably would not have registered at all once upon a time. You suddenly became much more aware of, that is, those all around you who tended to focus on the negative that rather than the positive and not being particularly grateful for the good things in their lives. How did you end up dealing with that hypersensitivity to ungratefulness or ingratitude that was all around you?
It's very interesting, and it's an interesting topic that you bring up because it did happen, and it happened with a close friend who is a wonderful person, but does tend to be somebody who will always find what's wrong. And we were out to dinner one night, and she was telling me all of the terrible things about her job. And I had, by that point, changed my focus on things, and so I was trying to point it out to her. I was saying, yes, but, you know, you still have a job, first of all. You actually love your job. And her complaint was that her job had moved to a place that was difficult to get to, and she didn't like her commute, and she didn't like her new office. So I was trying to point out, but it's not such a terrible commute, and you still love the people you work with, and you know, there were, needless to say, there were a list of 10 good things, and she was so mired in seeing the negative that she couldn't get out of that. And I went home so frustrated that evening and told my husband I didn't think I could still be friends with her. But somehow I think the conversation and my perspective and what I was trying to say to her finally did hit. And she called me a couple of days later, and she remarked on something else that she was grateful about. And she said, you know, I was thinking about what you said, and she told me another story and something that wasn't work-related but that had made her grateful. And I was so happy to realize that that you can make inroads. No matter who you are, you can start to change. And maybe it's not going to happen the first day, and maybe it's not going to happen on the one topic that's most frustrating to you. But I think the nice thing about gratitude is that it spreads. And one of the pleasures for me of writing the gratitude diaries and talking to people about it is that everybody I would tell that I was writing about this book, they would say, oh, yeah, I need to be more grateful. Or, oh, yeah, I've been thinking about that. It's really something that I should do. I think somewhere we all understand just how important this is. And what I'm really excited about with the gratitude diaries is that I hope it's fun, and it's fun to read, and that it tells my story as well as other research, and that I hope it then will inspire people to figure out how they can do that in their own lives. It's not a particular formula. I'm not saying you have to do X, Y, or Z. I'm saying it's so much in your control. And that's one of the great pleasures of gratitude, is that it gives you that sense of, I can control being happy. I don't have to wait for something to happen. I can make myself happy. And I think that's pretty exciting for all of us to realize.
Say a quick word about how this left you transformed once this year-long project was over. I mean, that very next day, did you find yourself living exactly as you had during this year-long project?
Well, you know, I had the great, great pleasure of getting to live this book as my work, and getting to make gratitude part of my work. So, of course, I slipped back a little bit in the 6-8 months since that year ended. But it has become so much a part of my life, and I'll give you a very specific example that I've not shared yet because it just happened. The book was coming out this week, and this past weekend I was a little anxious about it, you know. And I woke up and I thought, I know this book should have an impact, and I want people to read it, and will it happen? And I was going to be on the Today Show, and I was going to be doing these radio shows, and so I was really worried. And I went out for a walk, and I started thinking, wait a minute. What are you grateful for? And I paused and I thought how grateful I was that I got to write this book, and how grateful I was that people were going to read it and maybe be able to change their lives. And as I walked, it just completely changed how I felt, and the anxiety just slipped away. And I thought, I hope the future is great, and I hope this does well, but if it doesn't, I'm okay, because the moment and the experience to do it was great, and I'm grateful for that. And so I hope that's what gratitude can do for us. It can make us say, we still want a lot for the future, but hey, I'm going to stop right now and say this moment is pretty good in itself.
It reminds me of one of my favorite sayings about gratitude. If we pause to think, we will have cause to thank.
That's lovely.
And I think your book is lovely. It's called The Gratitude Diaries, How a Year Looking on the Bright Side Can Transform Your Life, published by Dutton. Janice Kaplan, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about your most intriguing and valuable book. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
The time is 8:32, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Part two of today's program is coming up in a moment. My guest on today's morning show has a very, very famous name, and also a heartwarming story behind that name. It is the name Boyardee, as in Chef Boyardee. And sometimes when you see an iconic figure on a package of food in the grocery store, it's nothing more than a fictional persona that somebody in marketing has dreamt up. But not in this case. There really was a Chef Boyardee and an entire Boyardee family, a family actually that was in the restaurant business before they went into the business for which they are now even more famous. And one of the descendants of the Chef Boyardee, Hector Boyardee, is a great niece, Anna Boyardee, who is a very busy person with all kinds of cooking exploits to her credit. You've perhaps seen her on CNBC or the Today Show or the Style Network, is often on QVC as well, and has her own dessert line, Delicious Memories, which happens also to be the title of her wonderful book, Delicious Memories, Recipes and Stories from the Chef Boyardee Family. And we will talk with Anna Boyardee about her family, about the wonderful world of Italian cooking, and about some of the delicious recipes, which indeed are part of this book. Anna Boyardee, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I am very, very excited about this, and I suspect that a lot of our listeners were as surprised as I was to learn, in fact, that there really was a Chef Boyardee and a real Boyardee family. And I suppose even at this point in time, you continue to encounter people who are similarly surprised.
Oh, every day. That was part of the reason why I wanted to do the book, because I wanted people to know that there was a real family behind the brand, but also a family that had a real culinary history. And anywhere I go, when people hear my last name, they say, oh, like Chef Boyardee, ha ha ha. And then when I explain to them that it was a real family, they're so interested in the story. So I used our family story as the backdrop to this cookbook, and wanted to share all these great family recipes with everybody.
I wonder if you could share with our listeners something which actually you mentioned rather briefly in the preface or introduction to the book, but something which evidently befell your father, and I hope it was just a temporary setback, which involved his memory. The impression we get from reading about that is that this moment helped kind of galvanize you to want to gather and write down and share with the world some of these stories. Tell us what happened to your father, if you would.
Yes, well, my dad developed what they think was a form of epilepsy. This is, later in life, and I was already in my 20s when this happened. And he really, for a year, had at least, he had very limited memory. So my dad is this incredible storyteller, and, he's has had this incredible life and a very colorful personality. And when that happened, it was like the door had closed on all of his memories and a lot of our family stories at a time in my life when I was just really starting to become interested in his past, as a young adult. And when his memory came back, which, through a lot of therapy and finally the proper medication about a year later, I started having him tell me a lot of things, and I was writing them down because I felt like if it were ever to happen again, the door may be closed permanently. And just for my own personal, just for my own personal collection, and just to have stories to pass down to my children and to my grandchildren. And that was one of the things that led me to the book, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad that you've gathered these stories together, and it is indeed a wonderful book. Again, we want to remind our listeners it's called Delicious Memories, Recipes and Stories from the Chef Boyardee Family. So, you tell us that the Boyardee family was really a family of restaurateurs, and we understand that the first of your great uncles came over to America early in the 20th century. Tell us what precipitated the move from Italy to America for these great uncles, one of whom was the famous Chef Boyardee.
The company was founded in 1928 by my grandfather, my uncle Hector, whose picture's on the can, who was, the driving force behind the brand, and their older brother, my uncle Paul. And they had come from a city in Italy called Piacenza, and they came from a very poor family. And when they were all very young, starting at the ages of 7 and 8, they all started working because there was really no money for them to be educated, and they had to, participate in the family finances. And so while they had no formal education, kitchens and food was their education. So they grew up really having an understanding of restaurants, of food, and lucky for them, that was also their, as they got older, that was also their passion, so they were able to combine the two. My uncle Paul, who was the older brother, came over first, in the early 1900s, and he sort of remained for a long time as the maitre d' at the Plaza Hotel in New York City, which was a job that had a lot of cachet at the time. And my uncle Hector came over, it's like around 1917, and he actually ran the kitchen at the Plaza Hotel, and he was around the age of 20. So that was, you can imagine
what a huge job that was, and a real testament to his skill set, being that age and being able to run a kitchen of, you know, that even at that time was a very famed hotel. And my grandfather also, you know, came over, and he had been working in Europe in restaurants, and then started working on cruise lines, and then came over to the United States, and then also started working at the Plaza.
Right. So, by the way, as you describe your grandfather coming to America, you describe it as him sort of forgetting, in quotes, forgetting to get back on the ship and returning to Italy. Is that sort of the way it happened, or is that just kind of family myth?
No, that's how it happened. And, you know, I never knew that story until I was putting the book together and you know, and sitting with my dad and my dad's brother and, you know, and trying to sort of be historically accurate. And I said to my dad, well, maybe I should go to Ellis Island and see if I could find their names, because I knew that my Uncle Paul, my Uncle Hector came through Ellis Island. And my dad started laughing, and he was like, well, maybe we don't want to put this in the book, but don't go there because you're not going to find your grandfather's name. And I was like, why? What do you mean? And he's like, well, he came over on a cruise ship, and, you know, he just sort of forgot to get back on. But, you know, it was a different time in the world, and eventually he worked it all out, so it's okay. But that is what happened.
So your great-uncle Hector began working in other restaurants and eventually ended up opening his own. Tell us about kind of that dramatic step for him.
So, you know, you're talking about, you know, early 1900s, early 1920s, and Italian food in the United States was not what it is today. It was certainly not as chic as it is today. It was not as ubiquitous as it is today. And they felt that there was a real opportunity to, outside of New York, to sort of introduce Americans to the concept of Italian food. And my Uncle Paul remained at the Plaza, and my Uncle Hector decided that he would move to Cleveland because he felt like there was some opportunity there. And my grandfather had also followed him, and my Uncle Hector had actually a few restaurants in Cleveland, because he opened one and it was very successful, and then he went on to another one. And what they found is that not only were the restaurants successful, but that customers were very interested in the type of food that was being served, and would always ask, well, how can I make this at home? And how do you make pasta? And could you possibly give me a little pasta to bring home so I can try to cook it myself? Because I'm trying to recreate what we are having in the restaurant, and it's not quite coming out the same. And they had this idea, just based on the interest in the food that they were serving, that what about if we started jarring our sauce or canning our sauce and selling it? You know, perhaps that's an opportunity to even, you know, take our food, you know, further across the United States. And that was really sort of the, you know, initial, like, just a little seedling of an idea that now is Chef Boyardee, which is 80-some-odd years later in this, you know, very sort of iconic brand and still actually the number one selling canned pasta in the United States.
You tell us that it was a great success right off the bat, and they launched their brand with three different sauces.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my Uncle Paul was still at the Plaza Hotel at the time, and the three brothers had come up with this idea to create this company. And my Uncle Paul, you know, there was, at the time, the Plaza Hotel was, as it is today, was this sort of very iconic, important place, and with a lot of, you know, sort of like famed people and important people coming through the doors. And one of his clients at the hotel was a man named Mr. Hartford, who owned all of the A&P supermarkets. So my Uncle Paul went to him and said, and he had known him very well because he had been his client, you know, over many years, and said, my brothers and I are thinking about starting this business, and if we start this business, would you support us, and would you test us in your supermarkets? And he owned, you know, A&P Supermarkets was the largest chain of supermarkets in the United States at the time. And having known you know, my Uncle Paul, but also my grandfather and my Uncle Hector, and having, you know, and known their pedigree and their history and had experienced their food, he said, absolutely, I will absolutely test you. And so from the beginning, they had the support of the largest supermarket chain in the United States, and he tested them, and it worked. And, you know, even in today's standards, if you could get the largest supermarket chain in the United States behind you, you would be a success out the gate. They were able to have continued success, which is, you know, which was incredible, but they had a good start.
Tell us about the move from Ohio to Pennsylvania.
You know, as the company started to grow and as they started to sort of understand what their needs were going to be, they needed to go somewhere where they really had access to a tomato harvest. And they found, you know, this place in Pennsylvania, and there were actually not a lot of tomato farmers in the area, but there were a lot of potato farmers. And they went there, and they convinced the potato farmers to convert their crops to tomatoes. And they ended up in Milton, Pennsylvania, and this was a town that was really, this is 1928, and this is a town that was really sort of struggling and had some steel mills that were dying, but the economy of the town had really slowed down tremendously. And they, you know, bringing the factory there, they really revitalized the area and the economy of the town, because they employed so many people at the factory. They, you know, it brought in all kinds of jobs. And to this day, the Chef Boyardee factory is in Milton, Pennsylvania, and still quite a large part of the economy of that town.
Hmm. I think, you know, for most people now, when we think of Chef Boyardee, we think of that famous can of spaghetti or spaghetti and meatballs. But when we look at some of the photographs of some of the earliest products that came from Chef Boyardee, a lot of it looks different, and some of it are products that are not offered anymore at all, but that when we realize it made so much sense in a day when a lot of people were wanting to have convenient Italian food to cook in their own homes. For instance, this matter of essentially an entire Italian dinner in a single box. Tell us about these wonderful box dinners.
Well, you know, when the company started, which is pretty amazing that it survived, it's a company that survived Depression, that survived World War II, and a time when women were really being forced to enter, you know, the workforce, because men were off at war. So there was this need for food that was nutritious, convenient, not expensive, and they came up with this idea of sort of putting everything together in a kit, so to speak. So one of the earlier products was a spaghetti dinner. So it came in a box, and when you opened the box, there was, you would have your long box of spaghetti pasta noodles, and then there was like a little can of sauce, and then there was a little can of Parmesan cheese, so that you didn't have to go through the supermarket and buy different, you know, find different aisles. Everything was just together in one box. And, you know, like I said, it was convenient, it was accessible, it was inexpensive, and it was nutritious and filled a void for something that, at the, you know, really was not available in the supermarkets at that time.
Hmm. Of your great uncles who started this company, actually the only one I think that you actually were able to meet was Hector, the driving force, as you called him, and also the man whose picture we see on the box or the jar, right?
Right. My grandfather had died in 1961, so way long before I was born. And, you know, luckily, my Uncle Hector was, you know, was still alive, and I spent quite a bit of time with him as a child and remember him very well and was very fond and warm memories. And he was just, you know, everyone always asks me what he was like. And he was an incredibly gentle, warm person, very soft-spoken, was a great storyteller. And, you know, when I was putting the book together, I think it's one thing when you know you have a perspective of someone, and you know, especially somebody in your family, and you have certain memories of that person. But I went to Milton. I met people that had worked with my grandfather, with my uncle for, you know, 45 years, and they all had the same perspective of him that I did. So he was, he was the same person to everyone, and everyone told me that he was, and the same thing that with my grandfather and my uncle Paul, that they were all extremely humble. They were the same people that they were from the time that they were children to even after having achieved great success, and very compassionate people with a, you know, very strong sense of family and a very strong sense of community.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Anna Boyardi and talking about her book, Delicious Memories, Recipes and Stories from the Chef Boyardi Family. Her great-uncle, Hector Boyardi, is the chef whose image is on jars and cans of Chef Boyardi products to this very day. It is a company which he founded with his brothers. And a company, of course, which still exists to this very day. Anna Boyardi, one of my favorite stories in this book is of the rather extraordinary circumstances under which your parents met. And we should mention to our listeners, who I hope will seek out the book, that they'll only find this story if they read a certain recipe for rigatoni bolognese. And there's a reason why this story is attached to this particular recipe. Do you mind sharing this story?
Absolutely. Well, my dad is from, my grandparents are from a city, like I mentioned earlier, from a city called Piacenza, which is in the north of Italy, about 50 miles south of Milan. And my dad was traveling and going to visit his mom, my grandmother, because they had had a home that they kept there. And my mom is also from Piacenza. And my mom was training to be a flight attendant. And this is, you know, the late 60s. And because of things that had happened in she had an accident when she was younger, and she has a scar on her knee. And in those days, flight attendants wore like miniskirts. And she had passed all the tests to become a flight attendant. And you know, she speaks multiple languages and is very pretty, and so she was sort of the perfect candidate. And when she put on the uniform, they said, oh my goodness, you have this scar in your knee, and that might, you know, our passengers may find that unsightly, and I'm sorry, but you can't be a flight attendant. And my mom was already had passed all the tests and was basically given the job and a schedule and was supposed to not even be in Italy. And instead she went home very depressed, and one of her friends called her and said, there's this American that's coming, you know, to Piacenza, and I would love for you to meet him because you speak perfect English. And my mom said, absolutely not. And, you know, I'm not in a good place. I'm very upset. And she said, oh, come on, you can just practice your English and go out with him. You're going to have a good time. And that American ended up being my dad. And so she met my dad, and my dad jokes that he went to Italy for 7 days and he stayed for 10 years, but, you know, that was really the story of how they met. And Piacenza being so, is in the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy, so we're part of the region of Bologna and Parma, and is really known for its food. And so I guess my mom, you know, my mom is a fabulous cook, but, you know, once she cooked for my dad, that was the end of it.
Yeah, and this was the dish in particular that he was so very, very fond of, and that she wanted to make sure she mastered right to the
Absolutely.
Last detail.
And this is, to this day, it's one of his favorites, and so, you know, I had to include it in the book. It's, you know, it's funny because people will email me all the time and say, oh my goodness, I saw you on, you know, the Today Show, or I saw you on CBS, and am I going to find the recipe for beefaroni in this book? No. the recipes in the book are all, they're not the recipes that you find in the can, but they're all, you know, I like to say that it is all of my grandfather and my uncle Hector's food, and because this is the food that they also grew up eating, that I grew up eating, that, you know, things that they served in their restaurant and things that have been in our family and specialties of the region for, you know, generations. So I wanted to sort of show the other side of Chef Boyardee, not just what people know as canned food.
Right. And, of course, that's an intriguing part of this legacy that is absolutely lost on most of us. And in a sense, it's a legacy that is sort of at war with itself, in a sense, because on the one hand, we're talking about superlatively crafted food in the kitchen. I mean, like you would order in a very, very fine Italian restaurant versus food that could not be easier to prepare. I mean, open up the can and plop it into the pot and heat it up and there you go. And I mean, it's poles apart. Can you tell us just a little bit about the food that we find in Chef Boyardee products? Does it bear much resemblance at all to, in a sense, I don't know what you should call it, the real thing, or kind of the authentic food that was so important to, for instance, to your great uncles? Or do we almost need to think of it as an entirely different thing?
Well, I think, you know, over from the time that they started the company to today, it's changed tremendously. Just, you know, given it's become more Americanized and the tastes were really, you know, changed to adapt to the palates of Americans and sort of just go with the times. And you know, I get that question asked all the time, like sort of how do you reconcile the two concepts? And you know, like I said, I wanted to just to show sort of the other side of Chef Boyardee. And when I was growing up, my mom would let us have Chef Boyardee, and they had this pizza kit that I was very, like, much in love with as a child. And that was really one of my first forays into the kitchen, is that my mom, you know, would let me roll out the dough and put on my toppings. And, you know, I guess that was my equivalent to the Easy Bake Oven. But I have a niece and nephew, and they're 8 and 10, and they love Chef Boyardee. And I see, it's amazing to me that their friends eat it and love it. And, you know, they know what it is, you know, to have my mom make gnocchi for them, and they still like Chef Boyardee. And I think you have to be able to, I know not everyone has time every day, and it's maybe not reasonable. So I like to say, like, I think it's okay. You just have to create balance in your life. Like, I think it's extremely important to know how to cook, whether it's for yourself or for a family, but that it's okay, you know, if you're buying a frozen pizza or opening a can also, but you just that it's important to create balance, I think, you know, with any.
Anna Boyardee and her wonderful book about her family is called Delicious Memories, Recipes and Stories from the Chef Boyardee Family, published by Stuart Tabori and Chang. Next week's lineup of morning shows will include visits from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, and Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College, paying their monthly visits to the program. As you might have guessed, there'll be no morning show tomorrow or Friday because of the Thanksgiving holiday. But we do remind you that you can access the morning show archive on our website, which is WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com.
Our weather forecast is for mostly sunny skies today, at least until the late afternoon, with a high of 45 degrees. Light rain moves in tonight. Temperatures holding steady in the 40s. Rain is expected.